Hey, hey, welcome to the Listen Bitch podcast, your go-to destination for unlocking your full potential and embracing the extraordinary possibilities within you. This is a journey of self-discovery and empowerment as you explore the transformative power of stepping into greatness. I want you to come into alignment with your God-given power and your gifts, unleash your soul, and learn to co-create a life you love. As you become the writer of your own story, in this podcast, you're going to find the inspiration, practical tips, and sometimes abrasive nudge to take the leap of faith towards your dreams. You're in the right place. Buckle up so we can unleash your inner badass. You guys, today I have a little off the beaten path conversation, okay? I went back to putting up some posts in the podcast group I've had because literally all but about seven of the interviews I've had have come from that group, and they've been really great conversations. This one stood out to me today, and I guess because my brain has just been kind of, you know, it's a little diverse and just kind of goes everywhere, and it just stood out to me. So I think this is going to be a great conversation today. I have John Malik. He's in the military for 30 years. And he worked organized crime for 14 years. And he has his own podcast called Headlines in History. So you guys can check him out. I know a lot of you fall asleep listening to true crime and all the things. So I figured this would be one of those little perk your ears up, give you a little dose of something new. So, John, come on in, say hello, introduce yourself. And I'm honored that you, not only took the time of your day to be on the podcast, but you were patient in me running behind today. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, having the invite and getting a time to chat a little bit. I really do enjoy talking about what I did on the job in the organized crime world. And so let me give you a little background. I started in the military in 1997, but as a military intelligence analyst, and eventually became a military intelligence officer, what I am now. But the reason I bring that up is because that's what opened the door for me to get into law enforcement. So I worked as a counter drug analyst from, let's see, it was right after I got back from Iraq in 05. So 2006 till about 2008. And I was a soldier working as a criminal analyst for the DEA. And I got some exposure to the differences between doing analysis in the criminal world and doing it in the intelligence world, right? And that was my first exposure to wiretaps, specifically international narcotics wiretaps. And even though I didn't sit wires and I didn't do the things that the agents did, I was an analyst, I did certainly learn a lot. But in 2008, I got a job offer, which I took, to stop doing the analyst thing and then jump over to the New York State Attorney General's office and work for their organized crime task force. And that's when I became a sworn officer and started doing wiretaps on my own. Well, not on my own, right? But in the office that I was hired with. So, and you might imagine it is a very unique window into a world that most people don't understand and don't even realize exists. You know, I remember just coming out of the academy, I wasn't even on the job that long. And within just a couple of months, my perspective on everything that happens around me on a daily basis completely changed, because you just get insight into things that you just normally wouldn't pay attention to. And I could just look at parking lots and just see, oh, I know what those people are doing, and I know what those people are doing. And I can walk through the mall and I can say, oh, I'm pretty certain I know what they're doing. And hey, there's no reason for that guy to be sitting over there for 30 seconds shaking hands with somebody in a street and then leaving for no reason, right? So, you know, little things that you just don't pay attention to as a, you know, just an everyday person, because you have your own life and you're doing your own thing, right? And I spent, so it was 14 years. I probably listened to, boy, oh boy, a few hundred thousand phone calls.
Wow.
Plenty of text messages, video, everything you can imagine that gets sucked up in a wiretap. Probably 15 total wires, anywhere from local stuff. I live in upstate New York, so local stuff, Albany, Schenectady, Troy, that's like the capital region, we call it, where I'm from. And to my all the way up to my last case, which was a fentanyl pill case that began all the way down in Mexico. It led us to actually wiretapping some folks down in Arizona, some non-citizens that were living in the Tucson area, and selling hundreds of thousands of pills at a rip to New York City, Chicago, and then here in upstate New York. So, yeah, it's Yeah, it's a fascinating view into a world most people don't pay much attention to. And
My
go ahead.
question is, how far off is Hollywood? Because you know, there's a lot of shows about DEA, there's a lot of shows about crime and organized crime. Like, there's a lot of this is huge. So how
Yeah.
far off is Hollywood? Do they get it right?
Well, they did when they did The Wire. So that's the greatest show on HBO, in my opinion, that's ever been
Okay.
produced. I mean, I know Sopranos and stuff. Yeah, it's all a good show, right? But the people, the former cops that they brought in and prosecutors and defense attorneys that they brought in to do the research for The Wire, were spot on. And minus the fact that that show was produced a while ago and there's still payphones,
Yeah.
that is as real as it gets. And
Okay.
so the law, the probable cause that has to be built in order for you to go up on a phone, the surveillance that has to be conducted in order to verify who's on the phone, the relationships, like not only on the criminal side, but on the police side, right? That every cop's office, every narcotics team has a drunk, every narcotics team has, a brilliant female that just really just kills it and just pushes back on all the males because they're could be knuckleheads and so
Yeah.
it was as real as it could be. Yeah, so The Wire is where it is.
I do wear a bit of a tinfoil hat. I'll just be forthcoming there. Okay. A little bit of a conspiracy nut. Okay. So,
Yep,
my
let's do it.
question is how many, I mean, could you even be honest about this though? Like, how much is the government involved in allowing trafficking to happen for like building big cases or for even, I don't know. I just feel like there's a lot of dirty shit that happens.
Sure. Well, I can say that in my experience, I've never seen quote unquote the government get involved in allowing anything to happen. What you may come across though, and so this may be what some people kind of grasp onto, is that there are times when certain behaviors or certain transactions, I'll just stay in the narcotics field, are, I don't want to say ignored, but allowed to happen because there's a bigger picture in something much larger that's happening, right? So, yeah, there's no time when the US government is spending hundreds of millions of dollars on fighting the war on drugs and just saying to the Mexican government, for example, yeah, just keep flooding the streets with fentanyl. It's not a big deal, right? That's not true. But would it be true if maybe there was a large, say, DEA investigation and they knew there was an organization pushing fentanyl through the border in Arizona, and they allowed that to happen five times so they could grab it on the sixth time to jump to another level of the case? Yes, that happens. It's part of a strategy, because if every time, and that's what makes wiretap so effective. If every time you cut a crime off at its right at its immediate, when you're right there in the moment, you're never going to get anywhere else. If every single law enforcement action on the street in terms of narcotics was a buy bust, we would never figure out who the people are that are in Mexico and ultimately even in China when it comes to fentanyl pushing this stuff into the street. So, we'll go undercover and we'll let drug dealers sell stuff to us, and then we'll go to the next guy and let them sell drugs to us just because we have a part of a much bigger plan. You know what I mean?
Okay, that makes sense. What I'm sure that infuriates a parent who can lose a, you know, a kid to a low-level dealer and know that that dealer walks, you know, walks free. I imagine there's a lot of weight that comes in this.
Yeah, so let me make clear too that so when I say we won't do anything in the moment, that doesn't mean we won't necessarily arrest that person later.
Eventually,
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
yeah. So it's not like it's scot-free crime, you know what I mean? But it's just not, we don't stop it in the moment. And no, but there are also times, if we're going to be fair, that some people don't end up getting arrested because the information that they provided was more valuable than the crime in a sense that they conducted. So, yeah, there may be plenty of times when somebody flips, they start talking and they say, listen, I got it from here and I got it from there. And if it's a first offense, typically in New York, we don't have any other crimes on the person prior to this day, then they don't have a record. So they could potentially just walk scot-free if that's what the judge decides. I had prosecutors have no and cops have no control over that. We make suggestions to judges, but it's judges based on deals that are made between the defense attorney and the prosecutor that allow that stuff to happen. But And that's the other really challenging part about doing work like that is it's not all the things that you'd think. It's violent and it's difficult and yeah, all that stuff's real. But to me, what's equally challenging is dealing with the people who are struggling, because that's in order for the drug trade to exist, you have to have people that use drugs, right? And
Right.
there's been plenty of times when I've sat listening to phone calls with people that are just at their end, you know, and have become used and abused by profiteers that are willing to just take advantage of these people in their worst times and in their worst places so they can make more money. And
Right.
it's disgusting, you know. And some of my one of my favorite cases I ever did, you know, talk about all these pills that come from Mexico and all the guns, whatever. But my favorite was we had a girl that was tied into a jerk down in New York City who was using her to sell a bunch of stuff up here in upstate New York. And we ended up having to arrest her at the end of the case because she was reselling. I mean, she was taking ounces from this guy and pushing ounces into little towns, but she didn't have a record prior to that. And we knew after we arrested her and we debriefed her that not only from what we heard on the phone, but from her testimony afterwards to us that, you know, it was all part of a real addiction issue that she had. And it was legitimate. She wasn't just saying this because she was trying to get out of whatever she was doing. It was real. And we ended up working with her, and she ended up doing all the things that were asked of her, not even just in a law enforcement sense, but you know, things like, hey, I need you to make sure you call me every morning. I need you to make sure you show up to this rehab. I need you to make sure you do all these things. And she met every single one the judge asked her to do. This is a case that happened, let's just say, 8, 10 years ago. I just saw her on Facebook a year ago. She's now completely clean and she's a recovery specialist working for a hospital here locally.
I
So,
love that.
yeah, to me, that was my most memorable case that I had ever
Yeah.
worked for that little story.
Right. And you
Yeah.
get to see that come full circle. And I imagine you don't get to see a lot of success stories in this field. I think it's
You mean from
addiction
that
is
perspective?
horrendous. Yeah, from the
Yeah,
perspective
yeah.
of getting to see someone really get their shit together and not just get their shit together, she's out there making a difference,
Yeah.
helping someone else in that experience. So I think that's what I'm here for, to get those people that take the worst parts of their lives to turn that around to make a solid influence to help someone else,
Oh, 100%. And
So I love that.
she, yeah, she could have, you know, there's not a lot of those stories. And the reason I have
No.
it is because it's not common. What's common is we end up having people that lose their lives on the case and people that never get it turned around. And, you know, and she was involved in some pretty gross behavior, right?
Yep.
Because she was just at her bottom. And, you know, and I don't want to speak ill, but it's what's also a challenge for cops. Let me just put it this way, too, is a lot of people have a difficulty dealing with law enforcement at times because they often give the sense that maybe they don't care. They're kind of a little
Yeah.
rough. They're a little gruff. They're like, ah, you're just another addict, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm moving on to my next case.
Yeah.
There's some truth in that. And, but the challenge is the world that police officers live in every single day, it makes them cynical, you know, and
Of
it's
course.
really hard for cops to look at those people literally every single day and then attempt to try and make a difference, you know, in that one person's life. It's just hard. So I'm not trying to make an excuse for cops that are knuckleheads, but
No.
it's an explanation of how the entire drug trade from the user all the way to the organized crimes that are run by governments overseas creates such an awful environment, really, for the whole world, you know.
Right. I think that the world needs to have a different perspective just for police in general. You have to be desensitized on some level, or you couldn't handle going to your job. If you took every case and you brought that weight home every single night, I mean, you're going to blow your brains out or you're going to OD yourself. Like, there's no one in the world that can carry that weight. So I think it's just a matter of, the good guys praying for that discernment of like being able to see when they can see someone for real. You can see someone and think, I think that person has a chance, and it, I think it changes the game. It gives them that motivation to keep going. But just in general, I have a, son-in-law who just went through the academy for to be a trooper, and I feel like when criminals get arrested, maybe they should go through the academy to see like what a cop has to go through and endure to be able to be wearing the badge, to be able to be where they're at. I think it would change a perspective. But I think everyone, that's my whole thing. I think the world should just, take a step back and put themselves in the shoes of what people really do to get where they are. But that would change the world in and of itself. And, that's not our time. I don't think it's our time for that. But you have to desensitize a little bit. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's empathy is a challenging emotion. You know, people struggle with having empathy for the other side, and whether again, whether it is it's a cop who doesn't understand addiction, or it's somebody involved in a narcotics trade who doesn't understand what it's like to be a police officer. I mean, there's a reason why military and law enforcement are two of the two professions where they drink the most, right? I mean, it's hard to find people in, you know, from a career perspective that drink more than cops and soldiers, and there's reasons for that, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's certainly challenging for sure. But I will say, in my personal experience too, I'm a little different than others on the job, because one of the ways that I was able to learn how to be empathic was because I had my own issues. So I drank for a long time and drank more than your typical hard drinking police officer, right? Just this average person, and was doing things I shouldn't have done, and put myself in a pretty bad place, and could have lost everything on a couple of different occasions. And I've been sober now for 8 years, and so when I stopped drinking and stayed on the job, it was almost like a whole leaf had unturned, flipped over for me, where I now was able to look at everybody I was dealing with from a completely different perspective. And you know, I used to get guys would poke fun at me and whatever, because it's just different. But that changed for me, and I think so. I'm giving you an example of how you're absolutely right, that if you can experience the other side, whether it's people that have been involved in officer-involved shootings, where they go to a shoot, don't shoot training that cops go through to understand how difficult it is to either, again, shoot or don't shoot in a contested environment, or I'm not advocating that every cop turns into a complete wasted drunk and then just, but you get my point, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Congrats on that sobriety. That's a big deal,
Thanks.
man.
Yeah,
8 years
thank
is
you.
a big deal.
Yeah.
That's huge. And I
Thank you.
think it says a lot, especially because you're still on the job, right? Are you
No, so
still doing things?
I left 2 years ago because I went back. So before I got on, I was doing full-time Army stuff, right? And I just happened to be doing it at the DEA. So then I got on the job. I was there for 14 years. I got offered a full-time Army job again. It was like a dream job for me. So I made a hard choice and loved what I was doing with the organized crime, narcotics stuff. But it was just a really good decision for my family and stuff. So I took the Army thing. So I've been doing the Army thing now full-time about 2 years.
And is
Yeah.
that so what is that related to? What are you into now?
So I'm still doing intelligence work, but I'm the technically, I'm the director of intelligence for the New York National Guard. So I'm responsible for intelligence operations, kind of, but intelligence policies, security, that kind of thing for the adjutant general, who's a two-star general for the entire state, both Army and Air. So I'm like his senior advisor for all intel related things, you know. Yeah, it's
Have
fun.
you noticed the lack of intelligence in the United States lately? I feel like that would be hard
Yeah,
to
yeah,
be
yeah.
an intelligence officer at this point in time because I think intelligence is lacking.
Yeah, it's frustrating. There's no
I could
doubt.
not imagine.
Yeah. Reading the
I could
news
not
every day,
imagine.
and 80% of it, I'm like, yep, that's not true. And everything everyone just said in the comments is even further from truth. So, yeah. But
There's a couple things I read and I just tell my husband, I'm like, man, Russia should just nuke us already. Like, we
oh
don't have
boy.
our shit together. We do not have our shit together. But hopefully people like you in this intelligence agency can start weeding through the dumbasses. I don't
Yeah, I wouldn't
know.
we could I don't want to switch the conversation too far, but I wouldn't be too worried about Russia, but I will tell you that China is pretty damn good at what they do. And if I have any fears, you know, I'm not an ultimate fear, right? Like, we're never going to lose, but China's pretty damn good at what they do, especially from an intelligence perspective. So anyways, but
So if we ever just want to end it all, we're betting on China. If we just want to collectively just blow up the world, we're like, China's got the button.
Yeah. Yes. I guess we can put it that way. Sure.
Got it. Good to know. No, it is ridiculous out there. So I imagine that your job is highly frustrating, and especially because I feel like the media is a business. It's not a place of truth. It's not a place of anything. So that's got to be frustrating because you're dealing with a mass amount of people who are, you know, take all of this for point value and make decisions in their lives based on that. And I think it's just a mess. It's a mess.
Yeah. I actually have a thought that, especially when we get into this world of AI. So, because you're totally right. Media is a for-profit business. And so you struggle to weed through the nonsense to get to the truth, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have the compounding factor of AI, which you're going to have within 5 years, we're going to have video so advanced, we're really not going to be able to tell what's true and what isn't true. But I'm optimistic. And I think that the world works with pendulums. And I think we're going to get back to a place, because there will be so much chaos and so, what I mean chaos is informational chaos. There'll be so much informational chaos and so much nonsense that the trusted folks will come back and be relied upon, right? They'll have to be, because humans are still going to want to know what is true. And so it'll get so bad that the trusted folks will kind of rise to the top, and we'll get back to a place where we can shut off all of the crap and then just stick with what we think is true. So that's my optimistic story of the day. We'll see.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I'm still waiting. I feel like technology was great until it's not. And I'm, you know, I am a fan of it. I utilize it. That's how my business works. But the AI thing, there is a level of too much. And obviously knowledge is not power for us, because we're getting dumber by the minute. You know, we are not rising to this occasion. So that is interesting, though. It is interesting.
Yeah, we'll see. I just, you know, I'm just trying to take the long game. You know, I don't want to be pessimistic and say, listen, we're turning into Terminator and that's it. It's all over. And Elon's right, because Elon thinks AI is going to take over and we're just going to lose. I'm hoping the long game is the right one. And we'll figure it out. Fingers crossed. I don't know.
Right. Someone will figure it out. Yeah. Let's hope. Right. Let's hope.
And hope it's the good guys, whatever that means.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do flip the script and I take this place all over the place because my brain is wild. So I want to go back to, we got to talk about your favorite case. Is there a case that was like the hardest for you? Like the most emotionally draining case where you were just like, you were ready to tap out. I imagine you had several question. If, you know, you were disappearing into a bottle consistently. I imagine there was a lot of stuff that really weighed on you. But is there anything that stood out that just kind of kept you up at night for a while?
Yeah, I would say my second case. So I was a part of probably 15 cases in the 14 years that I was there in one part or another. But I was what we call an affiant for three of them, which basically means I was the senior investigator and I was the one that swore to the judge on all the facts and cause in the case. So my second of those two was in 2014, and it was a gang case where the city of Albany and right across the Hudson River where I'm from, the city of Troy, they were having with their young kids, they were literally having like a little gang warfare. And local gangs, it wasn't anybody tied into the national scene, but it was getting bad. And when I say bad, there's an interstate that runs directly north-south along the Hudson in Albany. And it's the interstate that everybody takes to go to work every day, right? And eventually at one point during the summer of that year, I think it would have been in the summer of 13 before we started the case in 14, one group of knuckleheads saw another group of knuckleheads in another car, and they just started shooting at each other on the expressway, driving southbound into Albany, just around everyone else trying to get to work and everything else. And so that was the impetus for the case, because the mayors got together and they went to law enforcement locally and was like, this is enough, right? Like, what are we going to do, right? And so eventually what happened is my office got the lead on the case that we ended up deciding, you know, we're going to have to do a wire on these folks and see if we can figure something out. And so we ended up buying into, we ended up buying some crack into a kid who was part of the Troy side of the Troy's side of the house and kind of like branching off and getting a whole bunch of these kids arrested, and it really calmed things down for a couple of years, which was kind of a good win. But during the case, it was so challenging to deal with listening to these kids. And when I say kids, I literally mean that. They were adults, but it was 18 to 24, right? And
Yeah.
so in my perspective, in my
Babies.
experience, yeah, we're normally dealing with 25-year-olds to 45-year-olds. These are kids who have been out of school since they were 10, and they've been carrying guns since they were 13. It's the only thing that they understand, and the only language they have is violence. And so they're using drugs themselves. They're selling drugs to everybody they can get their hands on. I'm listening to conversations with their parents because they happen to be on the phone when they're doing it. And if their parents are even there, that's not even a relationship you can understand. And then they just spend the rest of the night outside shooting at each other. I mean, we just have shootings, you know, two, three times a week. And I'm not saying everybody got shot in that sense, but two, three nights a week, they're just shooting at each other. They're driving across the bridge, driving across the Hudson. And we lost so many people. Kids died in that case. Adults died in that case. Adults from New York City died in that case. And there were plenty of nights when I was sitting in what we call the plant, which is the place you listen to phone calls. And it's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm just listening to whatever they're doing. And it's like, are we getting anything accomplished? I mean, I know we're arresting these folks, but what's going to happen, right? I just feel like next year we're going to have the same case. It'll be another investigator doing his or her thing. And I don't know. It was challenging. It was really challenging because I wanted to find that, you know, all of us doing work every day, you want to be able to say, I've got value and I'm doing something to make a change every day. And you don't see it in the moment, you know, you don't. So,
I think that's
and
true
I
with
was still drinking
everything in
then.
life.
So, anyways.
What's your perspective on the states that have, decided that they've decriminalized drugs where people are just free to use?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I think each society, and I say this internationally, has a different process and a different effectiveness. What am I trying to say? I know that out west, some of the states have made it easier to use, easier to purchase, and in trying, some of them are in a way to try and get them to use in a clean environment and reduce their addiction levels, those type of things. I think those are all great ideas. And but I also see how a few years ago some states have transitioned to decriminalization, and now crime has gone up precipitously, and now the same politicians, the same mayors are like, uh-oh. Okay, maybe we didn't do that the right way, right? Because it's whether we want to admit it or not, there is a correlation between narcotics use and sales and general crime. It just is true, right? People that are on their down and out, they can't get their hands on anything. They steal, they try to, you know, they rob, they burg, they do all those things. So, but if you research, for example, what Portugal has done with their decriminalization and addiction reduction programs, where they literally allow people to use heroin, but they require that they use them in a certain place. And then if they use them in a certain place, they won't get arrested. They'll even provide them with the heroin just as one drug. And they do things like once somebody is off of, if they get to the point where they can stop using, they mandate businesses hire former addicts at 50% of the salary cost in order to put them back to work. So a business, for example, would normally pay somebody $20 an hour to do X work. Well, the government will say, listen, pay them $10 an hour. I'll pay the other $10 an hour. So the value still gets to the former addict. The business saves 50% on salary cost, and the government is trying to keep people from staying sick, right? And you can do the reading that has made a real big effect on Portugal and their drug issues. So now, the reason I say it depends on societies is what's happening in Portugal going to work in New York City? I don't know. I'm not a sociologist, right? But my answer would be, I think it's, with all of that said, my answer would be, I think it's a good I think it's good that people are thinking of alternative ways to try to fix the issue rather than just hiring more cops and arresting more drug users, because that hasn't gotten us anywhere since the Reagan administration, and it's not going to get us anywhere tomorrow.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
What do
That's my
you think
answer.
the big help would be if you were going to implement an idea, because you've seen it, you've seen the addicts, you've been out there with them. What do you think would be the first step in really making a difference in whatever you call the war on drugs?
Yeah, it has to be addict focused, right? Because without those out there looking to use, then there's nowhere to sell. And
Right.
so individuals that are working to make more money, who just don't give a shit about the people that are using their product, they're gonna find somewhere else to go and get involved in another business and make more money. But the hope would be that they do it in a way that doesn't damage more people. So
Right.
focusing on the addiction issue and reducing the demand for the supply that's out there is, to me, the key. The problem is addiction is it's awful. If you have not
Right.
been beholden and to a substance, then you just don't get it. And so there are things that I did that I'll never say, but there are things that I did when I was drinking, and not even just things that I shouldn't have done legally, right? But behaviors that I was involved in that I cannot fathom doing today and would never accept from anybody else in my life, but
Right.
was practically normal behavior because I was so focused on just drinking. As soon as I would wake up in the morning, literally 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm like, oh, I got to go to work, so I better drink three or four beers before I get there. And that would just last all day long. And you can imagine the type of hoops I would have to jump through for that crap. But anyways, so and that's not even fentanyl slash heroin, which are
Right.
narcotics that even take a greater physical toll on users.
Right.
People have a challenge with having enough patience to deal with people who are in those places. But we have to. You just have to. And so I don't know what the answer is from a legal standpoint, what laws have to change, but the focus has to stay on those that are struggling, and we have to have the patience to deal with them. We have to give them the resources, and we have to stop using the law as a way to
A
change their
weapon.
behavior. It's just not going to happen.
No.
It's just not going to. You could have arrested me for a DWI and put me in jail, and while I was on the job, and I would have been released. And because I wasn't ready to quit drinking, I would have just drank the
Right
next
back
day.
to it.
Yeah, I just would have drank and I would have drove again. I would have. The only way you were going to be able to stop me again at that point was to
Yeah.
just put me in prison and never let me out.
What was the catalyst in your sobriety?
It was my family.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Well, so they say in AA that you get sick and tired of being sick and tired, and so I was at that place. I was really tired. It took so much energy and so much planning and so much focus.
Manipulation.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it just
I'm an
every
alcoholic.
day.
I know.
Yeah,
Yeah.
okay. Just to get through my day, right? And at the same time, so I was at that point, and then my wife came to me one morning and said, "Listen, I've just been I'm done." And she had been doing this. So it really flipped for me when I got back from Afghanistan in 2012. So from like 2014 to 2016, I was bad. And so she had been with me that whole time and just kind of doing whatever she could to try to keep me alive, really. And she looked at me in the summer of 2016 when I was at that point when I was tired and said, "I got a divorce attorney and I'm just gonna, we're just, I can't, you're just with this, and I have two kids." And she's like, "I'm not going to allow you." She's like, "I even if I believe in the whole addiction thing and it's not your choice," she's like, "I can't let you be around the kids and do this because we just can't. So it's over, right?" And I've called this person and I'm doing this thing and blah blah blah. And that hit hard. And the next morning, I had to go to work, and so I woke up. It was like a beautiful sunny day. I think it was a Friday. Anyway, so I went, got ready to go to work, started drinking. By 10 o'clock, I couldn't even get out of bed. I was supposed to be at work an hour and a half ago, and I called one of my friends at work, one of my colleagues, and I just told him I just couldn't do it anymore because he had known I was drinking really, really bad.
Right.
But he was an old school cop who was like, "Ah, I just sleep on the couch, you know. We'll take
Yeah.
care of you, you know, that kind of guy." He
Yeah.
wasn't like, "Hey, John, I want to take you to the rehab." No.
Right.
He was an old like started. He was a cop back in the 80s, so he was like,
Yeah.
"Just sleep it off on my couch, buddy, and deal with the wife later, you know."
Right.
So, anyways, but I called him and I said, "I just can't." And for some reason, in that moment, Megan said, my wife had said, "Listen, let's go away. You got to go away. You got to get this figured out." And I agreed to. And I did, and then I haven't drank since. So,
That's amazing.
yeah, I don't know why.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why I've made it 8 years. I mean, I could say that it's likely my family, right? I mean,
Yeah.
but and that's probably mostly true. But technically, why I haven't decided to pick up, and I just don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It's working for you. Whatever it is,
Sure.
it's working
Yeah.
for it's
Exactly.
working for you. It's working for you. And that I feel like that right there, you had something to lose. And what's unfortunate is the people that are out in the streets right now, they don't have shit to lose. They just don't. There was never a belief put in themselves. And I think that's just a losing battle. If you can't find it inside of you, like,
Sure.
I get
I
it.
agree. I do say today that if it wasn't for my family, you know, telling me that they wouldn't be my family anymore, I'd probably still be, I'd either be drinking or dead. You know, if I was
Yeah.
single and didn't have anything but some buddies, you know, who were all great, but you know, it's different having a buddy than it is having a wife and kids, you know, so,
Right.
or a spouse and kids, whatever. So I'd probably be either drunk or dead, you know. So you're right. That's the point, is that the people that
Yeah.
don't have some foundation, some connection, some passion, some love, some something that they feel that then yeah, they just continue to struggle. So
Right.
anyways, we got to focus on them.
Yeah.
Focus on them, and I think we do a much better job.
Okay, so I do. I mean, I think that addiction is huge. It's not just in the streets, it's not just with drugs. I know there's probably a lot of people that listen to this that probably struggle with something, if I'm being honest. I think everybody has a little addictive personality. So, how do you support them without enabling them?
That's a great question because you want to care, right? And you also know at the same time, though, that you can't force them to stop, right? There are soldiers that I've dealt with that are drinking too much, and I've taken them to a couple of meetings. I don't go to meetings anymore myself. I did when I first got sober, but I still, if a soldier's willing to open up to me, then I will take them and I will do what I can to help. But clearly I'm not going to buy him any booze, right? That's not going to happen. But at the same time, I'm not going to like tell on him, right? I'm not going to go to the commander and say, "Hey, listen, whatever. This kid's showing up drunk, whatever." I may help with command to try from a mental health perspective, and actually the military has done a really, really good job with that. And they're much better today than they were 20 years ago, right? So you can go to your commander and say things like, "Listen, I got a problem, bro. I got to figure this out." And soldiers won't get in trouble for that if they've stepped up to this. So anyways, my point is that you got to walk that fine line, right? So I don't know how really to balance not enabling but caring at the same time. I just Again, in my personal experiences dealing with others, I just continue to try and express to them that I understand and that I'm there to listen and I'll be there for them. And if they want to come over, or if they want to go somewhere, or they want to whatever it is, then I'll just continue to care and again show that empathy. And hopefully when that time comes and I'm there or somebody else is there, whatever, that time comes when their light switch flips, then they're in a good place to take it the right way. You know what I mean?
Yep, of course. I love that. Well, before we sign off today, I do want you to tell us a little bit about your podcast, Headlines in History, a perspective, kind of episodes you talk on, and what your purpose is of your podcast.
Yeah, so you know, like I said, we've been talking a lot about law enforcement stuff today, but my other passion, and I have been doing it longer, is military intelligence stuff. And I know that's kind of niche in a way, right? There's not a lot of people who are necessarily interested in that, but there is a, it's what I love, so it's what I do. And so anyway, so the purpose of Headlines in History is to talk about foreign affairs and military conflict that is important in the sense that it can affect everybody that lives here. Here, I mean the US, even though they don't necessarily know every day how that can affect them. And then give the history behind that, because there's a space between the people who watch the evening news at night, who get the 3 minutes and they're like, oh yeah, that's interesting, I don't care, I move on. And then there's like the real history nuts who will take a look at one battle in some, you know, foreign war and read 9 books on it, right? Like there's those people too, right? But there's a space where there's people who watch that 3 minutes on the news and go, you know what? I want to know a little bit more about that. Like, why are we even in this place? Why is it that Iran just shot at Israel 2 6 weeks ago? They fired 300 rounds at Israel. Why was that such a big deal in the news? Why is Iran even shooting at Israel? And but I don't need a book on it. Just give me the 20 minutes of why that's relevant and why everybody's protesting in the streets, but don't give me the book. That's the space that I'm fitting in. So, based on my experience, based on my 3 deployments downrange, I've been to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kuwait. I've been doing this for nearly 30 years. I have a perspective on that. And then it's something I deal with every day. So in my current position as the Director of Intelligence for New York, the New York National Guard, half of my job is to stay on top of the threats that can affect New York airmen and soldiers and affect the missions that they are involved in, and again, remain the senior advisor to the commander, the 2-star in charge of New York. So I live it, you know, every day as well. So the biggest challenge is, you know, going to work and reading things that I'm allowed to read and other intel people are allowed to read that you don't get in the news, but then talking about it and making sure I separate the two so I don't end up in jail someday. But that's that. And so once a week I come out with a new episode. The last, let's say, I've done a couple of interviews with some soldiers recently, but the last episode I did was about the helicopter crash. I don't know if your audience knows, but the president of Iran died in a helicopter crash. And there was a lot of talk about whether Israel was involved and because they had wanted to assassinate the guy or whatever. But there's a whole process behind what happens now in Iran and how the Ayatollah then replaces him and how that affects what's everything that's happening in the Middle East. So I talked about all that. And then the next episode I think I'm going to do is about what's happening in Niger right now, which is really bad. So there's another military coup that just started. The United States had a presence in Niger for a few years, but now the new military organization that took control has kicked the United States out. And so now Russia and China are filtering their way in. And so they're gaining a foothold in that part of the world that's not good for us in an
For us.
intelligence perspective. So that's, you know, that kind of stuff. Very boring to some people, but
No, I think
yeah.
it's interesting. I do think it's interesting. It just I am one of those people that I'll watch something and I'll be like, why are we getting in this mess when we're a total mess? Like, I feel like we kind of have to get our house in order before we can help other people. And I feel like we're sinking ship right now, man. We're a sinking ship. How are we able to, just have our business in other places? But I do think there's a big hole. I do believe there's a lot that we will never get to know that people like you get to read and know about and can't
Yeah.
really. So there is just, I think if your podcast is awesome, basically, if you can connect the dots between people that don't think we should be there and people that really know, like, this is why we need to do this, I think that's a great gap to fill.
Yeah. I mean, one of the biggest conversations, one of the most common conversations I have right now with people is, you know, why did we just give $61 billion to Ukraine in order for them to defend themselves against Russia, right? And what does Eastern Ukraine really matter to the United States when we have what, an addiction problem or whatever? So, and there's logic behind that, right? You can't dismiss that kind of thought process because it matters. It's the same viewpoint that a whole slew of Americans had prior to World War One and prior to World War Two, even when Hitler was running around and it was clear that Hitler was just a bad dude, right? And there's no reason for that man to live, but people in the United States said, well, why is that even my problem? He's never coming to the US. He can't get over the Atlantic. So what does it matter, right? The point I try to remind people of, at least in today, is that whether we like it or not, as US citizens, whether we like it or not, a decision was made post-World War II. And that was that the United States and its allies were going to become the world's framework and foundation. Mm-hmm. We decided, because we won, whether that's fair or not fair, right?
Right.
We and our allies won, that we were going to try and create an environment that would globally, that would allow people to prosper and create a security environment where people like Hitler, people like Stalin, people like Mao could no longer do the things that they were doing. And
right.
It just is what it is. And we've done that, excuse me, through the 20th century all the way until today. If we want to make a change now, everything's going to change. And what I mean by that is if we pull back and we say, okay, we're done with NATO because I don't care about Europe, and we're done with
right.
France and Britain because we've got all these other issues. The problem is other countries will fit in. They're just mm-hmm. going to do it. It's not going to be a place where they're like, oh, well, the US just left, so now everyone's peaceful. No, China will come in.
Right.
Russia will come in. It doesn't matter, because the people think, there are just so many people in the world that think that way. So we have a choice. The choice is, do we want to invest in a military, in a foreign policy that tries to keep the status quo, which has been, if you look mm-hmm. throughout history, pretty peaceful since the end of World War II?
Right.
Or do we want to just say, screw it, we'll build our wall, we'll go back inside, and we'll let Russia and China figure it out. And that's just not a world that I want to live in,
right?
Even though it's expensive. But I would rather have our imperfect politicians making mm-hmm. decisions about what happens across the world security environment than Xi Jinping or
right.
Vladimir Putin. So
right.
that's my little answer to that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it is just about part of that, what we were talking about in the very beginning, is putting yourself in a position to see the other perspective. You know, there has to be something beneficial for this that other people can see that maybe I'm just not looking at. So I've never really taken it too crazy, but it's still,
yeah,
there's still a moment there where I think, you know, you talk about the pendulum swinging. And I think that we're getting to a place where we've been pitted against each other for so long that really for the United States, like our next break is like civil war. Like we're going so far back. There's so much, you know, hate, there's so much division, there's so much just craziness yeah. that my idea is just like, I don't even know how do we fix it where we're at? How do we fix the United States? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's logic behind it. I'm not, you know, I'm certainly not one that denies that possibility, but
mm-hmm.
I try to remain optimistic. We were in a pretty bad place during the civil rights issues in the 60s.
Right.
I mean, we had senators killed. I mean, Kennedy mm-hmm. was killed, and then his brother was killed, and then MLK was killed. I mean, it was bad, right? And
mm-hmm.
we still had people in the South acting as if it was 1863.
Right.
And there, people were having the same exact conversation that we're having right now, where
mm-hmm.
people, we couldn't imagine getting out of a place because we hated each other. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So much. And we literally had that North South divide in the, you
mm-hmm.
know, the Mason Dixon line concept. And I would argue we're not there. The information is more readily available. So you just log onto your computer and you see it every day. So you're like,
mm-hmm.
oh my God, it's as bad as it's ever been. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen.
It's
not that any of that is not real, but mm-hmm. people in the 60s didn't even get the access to that, the daily feed of how bad it was and what people really thought and
right.
what how contentious things were. So I remain optimistic and say, you know, if we could pull ourselves out of that, President Kennedy came and President Johnson was a big help with that in the civil rights era after Kennedy was killed. And if we can do that, I think we can do this.
We can do this. Yeah.
I don't know when it's going to come, but
yeah,
we can do this.
I don't even see it as even, I don't necessarily even see that it's a race division. I think it is beyond that. I think it's beyond that. I feel like it is just.
Oh yeah. So let me say, I use that analogy not to say I think that's our problem today is race.
Yeah.
I just that happened to be the main issue then, although
okay,
there were
yeah.
other problems like economics
yeah.
and other things like that. Yeah. So right. So the core problem, you mm-hmm. know, the political divisions that we have today may mm-hmm. be more complicated. They may be more diverse, right? There's other things going on. It's not just the race mm-hmm. issue, but I still think that even it was just as bad then, if not worse.
Yeah.
Even though it was just race. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right.
I mean, you had literally people that were running around the South that if they had an opportunity to, the first time they saw a Black person, to kill, they were hanging people from trees in the 60s in the South. They would just, if they took a wrong turn down the road, and they would just grab them and hang them from a tree, right? It just, awful.
Yeah.
You know, so anyways, blabbering here. But so yes, it's not race today. There's more things going on.
Right.
But I'll still stay optimistic, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we need people like you, because some of us are just cynical at this point. We're the cynical ones. This is what with media just kind of being that business, we know we can't really trust everything we see. What is a trusted news source that you would point people to?
You're going to hate that I say this, but nothing's perfect. Nothing's perfect. And so my first answer is just read more. That's what I always teach my soldiers is.
That's what I tell everybody. Are you kidding me? Yeah. I would never hate that answer. Read.
Yeah. You just got to read more. Read, mm-hmm. read. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I'm not never going to be in the camp of, you know, do your own research, right? I don't.
Yeah.
Even though the thought of that is smart, but there's a connotation to doing your own research, and that is, you know, finding that one guy on Reddit who is just saying one crazy thing.
Right.
Okay. So that's obviously not what I mean. But if for somebody who's not a news junkie and isn't really in there 2-3 hours a day, I tell my soldiers, you read the New York Times and you read the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
Those are generally considered well-respected news organizations. Stay away from TV. So mm-hmm. get into print.
That part.
And mm-hmm. Stay off TV, get into print. And again, the Journal and the Times are both well-respected. The Times is well-known for being left-leaning, and the Journal is well-known for being right-leaning.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to stay in that centrist bubble.
You take a little bit of truth from everything.
Yeah,
probably some a little. Yep. And that's what I say for everything. I'm like, there's a little truth in everything. I feel like I don't think there's necessarily any blatant lies that are told, but you take half truths, because especially TV. And that's, I mean, I tell people all the time, don't watch the news. Just stay out of it. Just stay out of it. But people do want to be informed. So
Sure. Of course.
That's good to know. If they meet in the middle with the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, that's good to know.
Yeah. Just again, it's just, you're playing averages, right? Mm-hmm. You're just playing averages, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you're going to waste your time if you go way over on the right, in my opinion, and you're going to go mm-hmm. waste your time way over on the left. And the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are never going to be perfect. They're just not, but you're just playing averages and just mm-hmm. doing the best to try and get the most of the right stuff in your mind as you will. So.
That is awesome. Well, John, I appreciate you having this conversation with us. I just want to say again, thank you so much for your time, and congrats on your sobriety. Cause it may not seem like anything to you now, cause there's not a struggle, but that's inspiring for a lot of people. And I think it's really important that that's highlighted. I think the new cool is being sober. I think that's the new cool. So,
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, of course. And make sure you guys check out Headlines in History. All of John's information is in the bio of this podcast. So make sure you guys give him a follow. And I'm sure if you reach out and have questions, that he would be happy to answer anything he could. He is in the bounds of law, so be careful. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
But absolutely. John, thank you so much for tuning in today. I appreciate you.
Anytime. Thank you.
All right, you guys, I will see you tomorrow. Have a great day. Bye.